In my opinion, every business owner just needs to get around, you know, be in a mastermind or get around other people and just talk about deals, because we get blind to where our value is.
Absolutely.
And even in this, when I'm working with what I'd call the reinventor audience, that'll be someone who's recently sold or exited from a business and they're ready to reinvent and recreate themselves, they forget how many things they've seen, how much value they bring, and how one day of their advice can be worth $25,000 or $50,000 to the right fit business owner.
You're listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. This is your seat at the table. In today's show, Roland sits down with Mike Kenigs, 2009 Marketer of the Year. Mike has started, scaled, and exited four different times. And today, Mike reveals takeaways and lessons he has learned along the way so that you can make sure you're making money now and in the end.
Hey, this is Roland Frazier with Business Lunch, and I'm here today with Mike Kenigs. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roland. Nice to be here.
It is wonderful to have you, and this is a beautiful place we're sitting in today, looking over the Pacific Ocean and these ridiculously wonderful views that you have. I would love to start just telling people a little bit about who you are, so you don't have to brag about yourself. Let me start, and you help me pick up the slack, because you are an investor, entrepreneur, speaker, author, and a bunch of other stuff. So could you give everybody that's listening just kind of a little brief blurb about what you're doing now, what you've done? I know you've sold several companies, just sold one recently. And so just so people get an idea of who you are.
Yeah, I'd say what my superpower is I'm an amplifier. I'm really good at amplifying ideas and creating markets. And I've had four exits. So I built and sold four companies. And right now my focus is working as an advisor to business owners and helping them amplify their message, their offers, get attention, and position them for an exit as well. So I started building companies back when I was 18 years old, started life as a programmer first, so I've got a technical background. And right now, I am really, really interested in emerging markets.
Okay, like what? So what would you consider an emerging market? Is
space,
that a geographic? Okay, so more of a...
Space is $1 trillion opportunity. I'm actually involved in something. And I know at first when I'd hear something like that, I'd be, how could you possibly get involved in a space venture?
You're in good company, though, because I know Branson's got Virgin Galactic and Musk has his, is it SpaceX? And there's all kinds of investment in that area right now. And the one that you are looking at, can we say what they do?
Talk about it.
Yeah, because it's kind of cool.
Phoenix,
they're basically
space,
slingshotting satellites off of airplanes, right?
Yeah, so they have a unique technology that's considered game-changing technology by NASA for towing a drone glider that has a missile attached to it with a payload. Okay, so they tow it up to around, well, in the 20,000 foot range, and then the missile essentially launches attached to the glider up to the edge of the atmosphere. The missile is released from the glider. The glider flies back down to Earth, lands on a standard airport, and then the missile deploys the satellite. And so they're using technology that's been around for a long time, and they get past what's considered the hardest part of launching stuff into space, which is the 20 miles. And so it's really neat technology. Met the founders, was blown away. I got so involved. Not only I became an investor, but an advisor as well. And again, I would have thought years ago, it'd be completely impossible to get involved in something like that. But space is a $1 trillion opportunity right now. There's massive opportunities.
Let's talk about that a little bit. What is the mindset around that? Anything is possible. You can get involved with for people that are thinking, how does somebody get into something as kind of crazy or far out there as space might appear to be, even though it's not?
First of all, I've done a lot of stuff that is exciting and a lot of boring stuff too. And because I grew up in an environment where I was lower middle class, really had to work my rear end off to get to where I am right now, to have these beautiful views, you know, is I'd limit myself in my mind and say, well, that's just not reasonable. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. And what wound up happening, I think the answer to the question is, the secret to all this stuff is you just have to get around really interesting, smart people and belong to really interesting, smart groups. So the way I got into this opportunity is I belonged to a mastermind and someone said, Mike, something just came by my desk. It's crazy enough that I want you to take a look at it. I'm like, okay. And he says, and it's space. And of course, right now with what's going on, and Elon Musk is currently, as of right now, raising $500 million for SpaceX on a $32 billion valuation.
Right.
All right. So big opportunity, massive market, emerging, and you can gain access to really, really smart people by just writing an email, and you can track down anyone online today and say, I'm really interested in what you're doing. Can we talk about it? And mm-hmm. they will contact you. It's amazing. I mean, if you throw out 10 offers or opportunities,
right.
and you're the master of this, you know how to get in front of just about anyone.
Do you do any written letters to people?
I used to. I actually haven't in a long time. And I think that's just because now I've, you know, got somewhat of a reputation. So at this point, I've found that I can send out 4 or 5 text messages and say, do you know so-and-so? Right. And a couple people say, yeah, I can make an intro.
Right.
But if I were starting out, you know, from square zero right now, and I can go down a small tangent, but my wife Vivian has this nonprofit. She has been doing some stuff for 13 years. And she saw someone write something from a university, wrote her a really nice letter, not expecting her to come back, but she got back immediately. It was a result of that connection. Texas A&M wrote us, published a paper about the efficacy of her nonprofit, how well it works. Now she's been validated by a conservative, large organization, which has given her access to celebrities. And I mean, she's shared the stage with Michelle Obama, Clinton, and also attracted a whole bunch of substantial celebrities. Jada Pinkett Smith, for example.
Right.
A whole bunch of people were on the Grammy stage this recently.
So cool.
You know?
Yeah.
So and I think you just got to have the guts to dream big and ask for help.
So you came up in a lower middle class family. And what was your first entrepreneurial toe dipping?
I taught myself how to program when I was about 14 years old. And what happened was my dad started talking about how my kid started programming, and one of his clients, my dad's a barber, this guy in the chair ran an insurance agency. And he said, well, you think you can have your kid come in and teach my secretary how to use the computer? He's like, yeah, I think you can do that. So, you know, put me on the phone with this guy, and I went in, met with him. Taught her, I basically learned how to run, you know, database programs and spreadsheets and word processing, tutoring.
Was that back in Lotus 1-2-3 and
this
when all those were?
This is pre-Lotus, okay, but it was. Right. Yeah, let's call it Lotus 1-2-3. Yeah, right. It's back in the Apple II, Apple III, and the earliest days of IBM PCs, when CPM was an operating system.
Yes.
Okay. And this isn't that long ago, but it sounds old.
Seems old, yeah.
What happened next is a guy at the office said, I got this trucking firm. You think you can help me with my billing system? And I'm like, yeah, I can do that.
How hard could it be?
So,
and you can't look it up on YouTube. So where are you getting where are you getting your info?
I pulled it out of my rear end. I mean, literally, I was just like, yeah, I can do that. So if someone says to an entrepreneur who's basically broke, can you do that?
Of course I can.
Of course.
Yeah.
Now, will you do that might be another thing.
I'm sure
but,
I can give it a try.
Yeah. So what happened was I started writing code and literally figuring out how to write my own database architecture. This is back before you could buy like pre-written anything.
Way no SQL either, right?
There was no such thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I basically wrote a management system. I mean, it was, I had to write down, you know, it was down to the metal kind of stuff, and managed to write an app, and it evolved through multiple, and that client was mine for probably 4 years. Did stuff.
So you did figure out how to create the billing system for them?
I did.
Right.
At one point, the scariest, worst thing that ever happened was I had a triple backup failure where I lost all my source code. And I rewrote that entire system from scratch in 1 week. That's actually the worst thing that can ever happen to a developer, and it was the best thing that ever happened because at that point, what I was writing didn't work right. You know?
Right, yeah.
But from there, I got a real job writing vehicle simulation software for a company. And then I started writing video games.
Okay.
So I got a Macintosh, and I taught myself how to program the Mac. Here's the real backstory. I used to pirate a lot of software because I didn't have any money.
Right.
Okay. And the way I learned how to program is by deconstructing code. So I used to remove copy protection from games.
Okay.
And I went to a store that actually was run by a very famous heir of a beer company.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he met me and we just started talking. And it turned out they had a back room where you could go there and you could get pirate software.
That's funny. I used to have that with records.
All right.
There were concerts when people would record them.
Oh, yeah. Bootleg.
Yeah. Bootleg
records.
Basically,
that's what it was.
But the back room was the cool thing.
It was.
You're like, oh, this is where this stuff really happens.
So we started talking and he had some software. I'm like, yeah, I removed the copy protection on that thing. I removed the copy. And he's like, I got a guy you need to meet. So he put me in touch with someone who ran a gaming company and also wrote software that removed copy protection.
Oh, that's funny.
Of all the crazy stuff, right? And he was a master of copy protection. That was his deal. But
right,
yeah,
right.
You know, you got to play both sides of the market.
Yeah, so he was actually selling copy protection and also selling how to remove it. I love it. That's awesome.
Genius. Yeah. So that opened up a gigantic world. And I left the company I was at, wrote video games for a couple of years until the company got sold.
Okay, cool.
And from there, started an agency called Digital Cafe.
Okay.
That was the first interactive marketing agency, one of the first in the world.
Okay.
And had that for 10 years. And we had clients like our biggest deal we ever did was we wrote a video game called Chex Quest that was put on a CD-ROM and distributed in 6 million boxes of breakfast cereal.
Oh, you're kidding me. CHEX Quest.
Chex Quest. You know, the General Mills checks. Yeah.
Yeah, that's super fun.
Yeah. Sponsored by America Online.
Nice. Okay.
And we licensed the Doom game engine. If you remember Doom.
I do. Yeah. Absolutely.
From id Software. Yeah. So I met the original founders of Doom. We went down to Texas and did this whole deal. And we originally started writing our own. And we were like, oh my God, we'll never get through this, you know, on time. So we ended up licensing it. And that put us on the map. We started getting projects, doing movie promotions, CD-ROMs that shipped. We did a CD-ROM that shipped in Rolling Stone magazine.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's a bunch of crazy stuff like that.
So this is Digital Cafe.
Yep. And sold that company and then made a movie.
So selling that company, that was your first exit of
Big
four,
exit,
right?
Yeah. I went to a publicly traded company, the Interpublic Group.
So how did that happen? How does one do that?
Something really wild happened. So again, just like a connection of a connection, a friend of mine was a great connector and he did consulting with about 6 different advertising agencies in Minneapolis. Minneapolis is a big agency market, or it was at the time. There was a company called Fallon McElligott, which had like the BMW account, a bunch of others.
Sure.
Big, big brands. Can't even remember all of them. Like Best Buy would have been one of theirs, et cetera, et cetera. And an agency, the way they live, of course, they want to acquire big brands. That's what gets them more big brands to work with. And they make 15% on the spend, right? So back then, if you buy TV and media and all that, that's how you're making your money. You give away your creative,
right?
And you buy media.
Right.
So what happened was we picked up General Mills, and then we picked up a big healthcare service, and then we started picking up 20th Century Fox and Sony doing these games and that kind of thing. Well, back then, an interactive agency was a lot of big companies said, well, you need to be able to do interactive. It was like super sexy.
Right.
And this friend of mine said, some of the agencies are talking right now about acquiring interactive agencies. Do you want to be acquired? I was like, hell yeah. You know, so
yeah.
What he did is he created a bidding war and he went out to all 6 agencies and said, you didn't hear it from me, but Digital Cafe is being looked at by. And he just started fueling up the rumors central.
Nice,
yeah.
Nice.
So we had 3 inquiries in a week. And the first one with the letter of intent was Campbell Mithun, which had $1 billion in billing. Mm-hmm. And started the conversation. We were represented by a really good law firm. And the guy prevented us from doing really stupid things.
So that's a great thing to talk about a little bit. What stupid things almost happened? And did anything happen that you learned that informed how you approach these things going forward in the other 3 deals?
That's a great question. The first one is never negotiate your own deals. You got to have an in-between because you get emotionally involved and anyone who's a good negotiator can smell blood and ask questions. And a good business owner is just going to answer honestly. But it's just like, you know, going to a congressional hearing, someone knows how to find out all your weaknesses. They're going to know all your hot buttons and be able to grind you down to the lowest possible deal and you'll walk away with nothing. The other thing that when you're being acquired by a big company, very rarely do entrepreneurs ever survive in a big company culture. And what we did, fortunately, is we had negotiated with the help of our attorney, a double exit. In other words, if the company violated their agreement, this is what it would look like.
Okay.
So we got paid, and then we had a certain amount of ownership that was based on an earnout.
Okay.
And
an earnout is basically, for people that don't know, where you get paid on some formula. We don't know exactly. You think you'd like to get more money. They don't want to pay that money. So you agree on some formula for the future when...
Stick around, add value, you get paid.
Right.
In this particular case, this is right around the early 2000s. So it was when the dot-com thing was on freaking fire.
Yeah, it was a good time to sell.
And we sold it right at the peak and the bottom dropped. And what they were betting on, and we didn't know this at the time, but they're acquiring a bunch of other agencies. They were doing a roll-up.
Right.
And then they were going to do an IPO.
Right.
Now, I'm certain I can't reveal certain parts of this deal even to this day. Who knows, sure. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
But the bottom line is we had a disagreement, I put that in quotes, about hiring because it affected our earnout.
Ah, makes sense.
So yeah. The net-net is they were spending a lot of our potential earnout money to acquire people.
One interesting way around that, just as an aside, that we've learned and recently did a deal like that, is to have an earnout based on gross, so that you're not concerned about
all
of these, right, of these additional costs, because it's really easy to manipulate, even unintentionally. And if you think about it, if somebody's buying your company with the intent of growing it and they're going to put capital into it, well, the capital contribution isn't going to affect the profit and loss statement, but the spending of the capital that gets contributed will absolutely affect EBITDA or basically net, you know, profit that you're typically being paid your earnout on. So if you know that going in, then negotiate a gross earnout so you can say, look, whatever you want to do in running the company, cool, but what I'm going to get paid in the future is going to be a function of sales, not profits.
That's so smart. And just as, you know, the way deals are made these days versus those days,
right.
You know, like there's so many smart, creative people now. It's what I'm doing right now. I mean,
right.
I'm working with a bunch of organizations. Some of them are pure startups. Some of them are a later stage. And the owner's like, I want to get out of here. And I gave this one guy some advice. And I said, well, what's your FU number? What do you want to exit with? And what would make it worth your while to leave?
Right.
And he said, well, it's this much money. Let's just say it's $10 million. And I go, okay. And what are you earning right now? And he's like, well, about $4 million a year. And I just took a look at his numbers, for example. And, you know, his net profit is fairly low, like any small business owner. And
his earnings, his profit were $4 million?
His hard profit, yeah.
So hopefully you bought the company because of 2.5x on that.
Right on. Well, what I did is I was being an advisor that day.
Right,
so in this case, I was paid a fee
instead
of a back end. But the back end's an opportunity, right? But in this particular case, what wound up happening is I looked at what he was doing and where he wanted to exit. At the end of the day, I was able to look at his numbers and his books and his business and say, here's a bunch of places you're spending money. And your customers don't expect it, and you only want to stick around for this much time, stop spending that money.
Right.
Keep all of it.
Right.
You'll hit your $10 million, and you don't have to worry about all the ways, the contortions you got to go through to prep your business for sale.
Right.
So the whole thing is, it's like there's a million ways to skin a cat,
yeah.
A million ways to exit. And the kind of deals that I see people doing, it's sort of like what you just did, are so creative. And that's really why you need outside counsel when you're doing deals.
I just read Chip Wilson's Little Black Stretchy Pants, the guy that founded Lululemon, and he gives fantastic advice. All along the way, he had challenges and made kind of bad deals, and he didn't really know what he was doing, and he didn't really have the best of advisors. And so he gives really good learnings. It's a great book, by the way, to read, to take away. But one of the things he said is have three advisors who are independent with no vested interest in the deal, so that they're not going to change their advice to you based on how they're going to get a payout from the deal, and let them give you advice along the way that have experience doing that. And I thought so too. I was like, yeah, that's three advisors. And I advise people like you do on deals. And I think not having the interest and just being there to give them the advice based on your experience, that's pretty invaluable. I mean, it really is.
It's just, pay them. So if I looked at the other big piece of advice, and this is what I had in my third exit, which was Traffic Guys are an instant customer. And I know we'll kind of jump around here, but in that particular one, I remember the attorneys coming to me one day and we had our deal structured. And right when the wire transfer is about to happen and we're signing the papers, right? And it's, you know, it's a big number,
you know?
Got a multiple seven figures about to roll in.
Yeah, yeah.
And the attorney said, now, before you sign that, before we say yes, you need to know that this might be all the money you'll ever get from this deal. And and again, in a deal, it's very common to have a blended deal, meaning you get cash and then you've got upside and you've got whatever. And then you've got maybe a retainer or an agreement where you're going to stick around for X number of years. And you never expect any
maybe
of that.
Stock in the other company that's
totally.
Buying. Yeah, exactly.
And so are you okay with this being all you might get? And so that's question one. The second question is, will you be okay if the new buyers destroy what you've made? In other words, are you able to watch your baby being crucified?
Right, right.
And some people, they simply can't let it go. And being detached, doing the deep ego work is really, I think, the hardest part of being an entrepreneur is being able to let that go.
Yeah.
It's really easy for me now. It's just like realize that that thing is not you and to have an identity outside of your business.
Right. So in the first deal, any kind of mistakes that created big takeaways for you?
Honestly, the way that deal ended up, here's what happened. I had reached a point after 10 years, and that seems to be kind of my cycle. This most recent one was shorter, but I've been kind of a 10-year roller. And I was ready to go. And if truth be told, if I could have just walked away with some money and just started my life again, I would have been perfectly happy.
Was that because you had something else at that point that you wanted to do, or because you knew that there was something else, or that you intended to retire? Because one of the things that's interesting to me is it's a lot easier to walk away when you have 1,000 opportunities, you have 1,000 ideas, and you know you're not done, especially if you're in your mid-30s and you're cashing out. You're not gonna retire, right?
I did not receive FU money.
Yeah.
I had comfort money.
If you had, though, would you have stopped?
No.
Would you have?
No, I couldn't. I did not have that ability or capability. I would say my deep programming is chaos, addiction, and fear of running out,
right?
Fear of not having enough, fear of not being able to recreate and start again, and fear of not being enough. Those have been eternally.
Those are good things to know about yourself. I mean,
yeah,
really.
I would say the majority of them I only overcame and really deeply understood this year. So if I'm really straight with you, you know. So
okay, so no real like big takeaways other
here's
than
the biggie.
Okay.
The best thing that happened was one day the new boss came in. It was shortly after the transaction, within a week, and he said, "You don't have to come to work anymore. We don't really need you here any longer." And that broke my heart. I literally went away and I cried.
And that was a bit of a blindside too, right? You were anticipating working.
Yeah, it was like, we don't really want you here. Yeah, and you're not a culture fit is really what they were saying.
Which is actually, I think, true of a lot of entrepreneurs because we are a different kind of breed.
Yes.
And so we don't fit especially into a corporatized culture, right?
Right. And what I wasn't prepared for on the day after we signed is he said, it's Christmas here. Buy whatever you want. It's time to grow this thing. I didn't know how to dream big. I'd lost that because I was operating in such a constrained box for so long with such limited resources.
Right.
And it was like, it hurt my brain to think outside of the box. And so that is something that I vowed would never happen again, that I needed to surround myself with a culture of huge thinking.
Right.
So the other thing that happened was shortly after the organization violated our employment agreement, I can say that, it's been long enough, and we just negotiated a deal out. And so I basically got paid to go away.
Nice, okay.
And it was beautiful.
Which is good,
and
you didn't want to be there at that point, right?
And the truth is everyone was cool. And they did the right thing for us, they did the right thing for them.
Was a takeaway then from that, the build in advance, the second exit in the event that
correct.
Things don't work out? Because that's a pretty good takeaway.
Yes, I would say that's absolutely true. And then be prepared for the other mental gyrations that we've already discussed.
Right. Okay, so then that was Digital Cafe. What was the next
So what I did next is I had some opportunities. At that point, I did make a feature film with my business partner. That was his deal.
Going the one out. About the Tesla?
This was called Bill's Gun Shop. It was an actual real feature film. We raised over $1 million. And we shot it, and then it got distributed by Warner Brothers. Okay. And it's still available. You can still find it.
Nice.
That was an experience where I learned very rapidly that the horrors of making a movie inside the Hollywood community with union and actors and all the rules, it sucked. And I vowed I would never do anything unless I could control distribution, which got me super interested in what was going on. And I started hacking search engines, and I got really interested in the web. And so I wrote an app that produced 50,000 web pages a minute to load it with search engine stuff. And that eventually evolved and turned into the product that became Traffic Geyser.
Right. Okay. And Traffic Geyser was a video distribution syndication kind of thing, right?
Right on.
With the design, with the intent to rank, right? Wasn't that the primary thing, to rank videos? So was Traffic Geyser the second exit then?
Yeah. Okay. Traffic Geyser Instant Customer, that was a combined. So Traffic Geyser was the video syndication. And at the time, I had two partners at first. And then from there, Instant Customer was the first platform that did two-way interactive mobile text marketing.
I remember, yeah.
Yeah. And then we ended up combining the platform and then building a training business on top of that. And that's how we met. And the sale of that wound up being the two software platforms plus basically the training marketing business.
So now in that exit, I guess the first thing, we know how you found the buyer in the first one. How did the buyer come? Was that an intentional, let's do an auction kind of thing?
Yeah. Or? So some of the backstory there, I had cancer in between. And when I recovered, I was definitely clear that I had to take a break. And the good news is the business survived while I wasn't participating. So I had a good team.
Right.
And we listed the business on a broker site. And the broker found a buyer.
Okay.
And so we probably fielded about 8 different buyers, potentials. And this one made the most sense. I have to determine exactly what I can say here. But what I can say is they were a publicly traded company with a money backer. And we're able to do the transaction. And then I was to stay on with an employment agreement with the team and then continue to do business as usual.
And how was that post-closing? Did it work out like you thought?
Not everything, for sure. So I got paid. That was great. And then there were some disagreements on how to manage and run, and also just some money things that popped up that were unexpected. And so I think the best way of putting it is everyone had the best of intents.
Sure.
And then, in my opinion, the business was more complicated than everyone expected. And determining what to keep and what not to keep is always difficult.
Sure. Was this an integration into another company, or was this a we're going to buy it and take it over as is?
Both. It was kind of, it was integrating. And then they fairly quickly changed the name. There was a culture shift. And that was always the plan.
Right.
And my goal was to remain a face and transition power.
Sure.
And I accepted that right from the start. And again, I was ready to do some different things.
Right, right.
And the thing I had in my mind was to start a show. I had my studio. I retained that. And I wanted to just start doing a syndicated online television show.
So what did you do differently going into that deal and the negotiations than you did in the first one? And what new learnings did you take away?
Well, the first one was still had an outside party negotiating on my behalf. That was the smartest thing possible.
Is that our boy Gene?
Yeah, it was. Right. And I thank Gene for that all the time. The next thing was we built up a sales team while that was happening. So we were very smart to get rid of unneeded parts of the business. And we bolstered the value of the company. And timing-wise, what worked out to our advantage was we increased the net profit of the business by elimination.
I think that's a really important point. And we did that recently as well. And even when you go into the deal, if a deal is done based on EBITDA, which is basically profit for people that don't know what EBITDA is, pre-positioning before you go to sale and looking at all the things that aren't working and that you don't need and getting rid of all those, because there's a lot of clutter in a business,
You've
right?
You've got to have big cojones to run a business and be honest with yourself. That takes an enormous amount of ego discipline.
How much roughly of, in terms of dollars of stuff, would you say you got, or that you found that you could get rid of that you didn't need?
Oh, there must have been hundreds of thousands in monthly expenses.
Yeah. So for every 100,000 in monthly expenses, so for every 100,000 in monthly expenses, you're talking about $1.2 million. Let's say it's a 5 multiple, right? You're $6 million for every one of those in terms of value that you're not going to get if you don't clean that stuff out.
This is something a good friend of mine who's a very, very successful exiter told me. He said, you need to do an audit every quarter, because time kills deals. And so the amount of time it took to do a full audit, and something that we discovered, we had contractors we had been paying for years who no one even knew who they were. There was money literally being sent to the Philippines and elsewhere, thousands of dollars.
We find that with software too. We do that quarterly with our software. We actually started putting all of our software subscriptions on a separate card. So we have a credit card that only has software stuff on it, and it gets audited quarterly. And invariably, we'll find $10,000 to $50,000 a month of stuff we're not using anymore that was the best things in sliced bread that we had to have.
I jokingly call that drug money.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Drug and booze money.
Yeah, it's crazy.
There was a period of time when our monthly overhead was well over $500,000 a month, and that's... It was well over that, you know, it's like, and where, you know, you're wondering, why am I not taking home a paycheck this month? You know, like,
or I would like to have that extra $100,000 and that extra $6 million once I sell. So you found a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. The illusion that you need certain things is just that.
Yes, it really is. Mm-hmm. Okay. So one big thing was let's cut all the fat and pre-position the company in terms of its profit so that you could maximize the return on selling. And you weren't cutting out key things. You were just saying, hey, there's just a lot of stuff that accrues in a business that you accumulate over the years and don't need.
Yep. Okay. And then the other thing that we did do is we had excellent timing for a couple of product launches. So what happened to the buyer, we put on this great pressure. So it was like, well, when are we going to do the deal? Now, both sides want to get the deal done, but the other side really wants to get the deal done if they see you're generating a whole bunch of money and keeping it.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So suddenly our quarterly net profit got really, really high. And then what we did is we scheduled another launch.
So you scheduled the launch intentionally to make the deal happen faster.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That was really smart.
And we did.
All right. So that's two things. That pressure thing is pretty cool. What else? Anything else?
This is, again, where negotiated an exit. So a double exit. Mm-hmm. And I will say that this is another very, very important thing that I would say. I have a good friend, and he wouldn't mind me telling this story. His name's Famous Dave. Famous Dave's Barbecue.
Oh, okay. Nice. And, I've had his sauce.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a super, super nice man. Now, he is Famous Dave. And he had a publicly traded company. And when he left that publicly traded company, he was no longer Famous Dave. So he had to change
trademark.
His... Yeah, they owned the trademark. He couldn't be him.
That was like Robert Mondavi, same thing, right, with the wine. Yeah.
Starting all over again is a son of a gun. When you look at statistically, if you have a hit, the chances of you having another hit are extremely slim, statistically speaking. So Famous Dave struggled for a while because he had to create a new identity. He could be Famous Dave Anderson.
Right.
But not Famous Dave.
Right.
And so what I was careful to do, I negotiated in my contract that if there was ever any breakup, that I would not have a non-compete. So if there's a termination for cause,
sure,
non-compete's end.
Right.
And that is, again, it's so often, because here's the jumble you could get yourself into as an entrepreneur, is if you are in a situation where you sign over your IP and your inventions and your ability to make a living.
Right.
And then the company just acquires you. And let's say that they do it for a limited amount of cash up front, and then there's an earnout. They could just sit on your stuff and never do anything with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you get no money. And you have a hard time making a living doing what you're doing. And if that that non-compete is 3 to 5 years, you're hosed.
Yeah.
So I think you've got to make sure that you have really, really wise IP attorney looking at things, make clear on what they get, what they don't get, and when you get it back, under what circumstances.
And the terms of your non-compete as well.
Yeah. And also non-solicitation, meaning can you have relationships with past clients and customers after a deal happens? Okay. Those are major
issues. And employees.
Yes.
Because they don't want you taking your key people with you as
right
well.
Right on. Yeah. Yep.
So that was a good learning. Anything else on that deal before we get to the next two?
That really was the letting go. It just came down to letting it go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then what happened? What was the next one?
Then it's you everywhere now.
Okay.
Okay. So that one, what happened was after that deal happened, I ended up basically buying back some of my training products.
Okay.
They wanted to be a software-only company. Mm-hmm. So, and part of the big value was the community I developed over time, and never underestimate the value of a community that pays attention.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we had created a product called Publish and Profit, which is how to write books, become bestsellers. We had another program called Consult and Profit. It's about a coach, consult, advise.
And when you say we, in this case, this is back in Traffic Geyser, or this is?
Traffic Geyser Instant Customer. Right. I developed
You kept the training from that deal. They bought the software.
They actually bought everything, and then I ended up doing a deal where I got my IP back, some of the products, but also the community. And then I decided to build out a product suite, mm-hmm. which was a combination of training programs, events, and in this case, no software. I love software, but one of the key learnings I had is nowadays to create a substantive software company, I wouldn't do it personally without outside money and really, really good management teams right from the start.
Okay.
Doing a garage-based software startup requires more stamina than I care to provide at point in time in my life. That would be a good way of putting it.
That's a good one.
It is. It's like the video game industry. There was a period of time when a one or two person shop could produce some hits. And these days, you know, there's teams of thousands.
Yeah.
You know,
hard to compete with it.
You know, and so software can be very, very similar. So in this particular case, built the business and again, brought it to a point. And really, I reached a point where I realized to expand and grow this, it took partnership.
Right.
Much like you did in your past thing. So
sure.
Brought in a really smart partner with experience in this business, in this industry that I felt would manage and maintain the brand integrity, and then I can continue to be involved.
Sure.
And I think the key learnings that I would recommend anytime you do any kind of a business deal these days is when you structure something, make sure you find a way to get paid, right? Make sure that there's some sort of a continuation so you get paid to support the growth, and then that there's a backside opportunity as well.
Sure.
So either you're able to develop more business, or you know, if it's intellectual property, that there's royalty opportunities or earning opportunities as well. And again, it's very, very important that whenever you're working with any of these deals, the one thing that I didn't realize until we're just talking right now, I've always had outside counsel negotiating the deal. I would have screwed myself. I think I'm old enough now to put something together and be able to have that conversation, mm-hmm. but you don't want to get involved in the details. Mm-hmm. That's what attorneys need to do, and they pay attention to where the big slippery slopes are.
Yeah, and even as a recovering attorney myself who's done a ton of deals, I have legal counsel on any deals that I do because you want a second set of eyes, and number two, you can't possibly be up to speed and educated on everything that's important. And I think that having the benefit of counsel who has eyes on hundreds of other deals recently is invaluable. And so no matter how great a negotiator you think you are, it's you're crazy not to do that. It's just, I know our legal fees on the last deal we did were, I think, $350,000, which is a ton of money, right? That's a lot of money. But worth every penny.
Absolutely. And here's something else I'll tell you. The other advantage is I've noticed now, because I'm in the midst of, I see a lot of deals, And there's an awful lot of, the word that comes to mind, although this is a bad word to use, is incest, but ideas get shared.
Yes.
And so when you see a trend in terms of a strategy for raising money or doing deals, suddenly within like 2 weeks, everyone's talking about it.
I call it the creme brulee rule, because when creme brulee becomes hot, the only dessert you're ever going to get in any restaurant is freaking creme brulee, and then they're going to have the chocolate molten lava cake, and then restaurants are just so like that in fashion. It's everything. This year it's pink, right? Everything's going to be pink. This year in food, it's going to be green beans and foam. You know, it's so that is absolutely true. It's really, and in deals, I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. And so you want someone who's been exposed to deals for several seasons as well, because you don't want someone talking about pink. It's sort of like, I want to talk about the yellow ones, the blue ones, the orange ones, and do a blended deal.
Don't want any foam with this deal, damn it.
Yeah. So there we go.
Okay. So now that was number three exit?
Yeah. And okay. The fourth was a smallish deal, but it's worth talking about. It was a pure intellectual property deal that I did. And the biggest takeaway lesson, it was a product I had co-developed with someone else, and it had reached a point in its history where I didn't want to do it any longer. And generally speaking, I think a lot of entrepreneurs will look at something and just kill it or let something fizzle or dissolve, not realizing that it actually has value to another party. Now, in this particular case, here's the big takeaway is something you create or develop, if it doesn't require you, and even if it still could, might have value to someone who's selling a similar, either a higher end or a lower end product and uses a gap filler. And that's what happened with this particular one is I found someone who, it was literally just at a mastermind meeting. I was having a conversation about this thing and the conversation was, well, if at any point you'd ever want to sell your list, I'd be interested in your list. I said, well, there's a product there too. And I described the product and it's like, and what I did is I said, I know you're selling a product for X number of dollars. What if you had a product that you could sell for like 1/4 it to all the non-buyers? Like, that's a really good idea. So we rolled around the conversation and the deal ended up being both the product and a buyer's list. And the way we negotiated it is we got royalties on that list for years after.
Nice.
Which provided quarterly checks right. In addition to the initial fee up front. And again, this is just so important that in my opinion, every business owner just needs to get around, you know, be in a mastermind or get around other people and just talk about deals because we get blind to where yep. Our value is.
Absolutely.
Even in this, when I'm working with the reinventor audience, that'll be someone who's recently sold or exited from a business and they're ready to reinvent and recreate themselves. They forget how many things they've seen, how much value they bring, and how one day of their advice can be worth $25,000 or $50,000
right.
To the right fit
right.
Business owner.
Right. So those are some great lessons for people who are thinking about exiting from your experience in that. And on the investing side and kind of the going forward now, we were talking earlier and you said you really consider yourself kind of a contrarian marketer, contrarian investor. What does that mean?
I'll start out by just making a bold statement, which is I hate social media.
Okay.
I think it's a disease and it's actually causing damage to the human race right now. I see it with, you know, my son who's 16. I see what's happening to, you know, just interruptions and societally what it's going on and how it's a time wasting. It's a time suck.
Isn't it bizarre that a lot of folks don't think to just turn it off? Like it doesn't have to be an interruption. We've had telephones for years. You cannot answer the phone. You can turn notifications off. But I guess the gamification of it has made it somewhat addictive that the little vibration in your pocket or whatever, now it's like, I have to see what that is. It's amazing. It yeah. really is.
Yeah. I think it's important that if you use social media for business, which I still do, that you're buffered. So I've taken a complete diet from it. I can't tell you how much extra time I have and how much less stress I have. And it's not like I ever really cared that much. To me, it was a tool and a broadcasting platform. And I've been an advocate for years. Obviously, I've made a living for many years building tools.
Are you still an advocate even though you hate it?
I think it's a tool that is useful for broadcasting.
Okay.
Right? But here's where the contrarian comes in. Last I heard, and someone smarter than I might have a better number, but I thought I saw there are approximately 6.5 million advertisers on Facebook right now, or at least advertiser accounts, which is a lot. And as you and I were mentioning before we started recording, you said something along the lines of, you know, Facebook or any of these media companies have a responsibility to its shareholders, which is to maximize shareholder value, sell as much stuff, and get as much money as possible.
Right.
When you've got 6.5 million of anything trying to buy inventory, you're going to pay too much. And most people you and I know have found it increasingly difficult, if not almost impossible, to make money with Facebook ads now.
Absolutely.
And I have a good friend. He was spending over $4 million a year on Facebook and can't get a return call from them. That's unconscionable.
Yeah, that is the tech world. It's not a customer service world, which is really odd since customer service to me seems to be trending.
Absolutely. It's weird. So in the midst of noise, that usually is going to precede some sort of a correction.
Yes. There will also, I predict, be a legal correction because we, at least in the United States, have this thing called due process, which means you get a hearing before you lose anything of value to you. And if you violate the terms of service, or if WordPress.org decides that you, or WordPress.com actually, decides that you violated the terms of service, I've been banned from that because I allegedly violated the terms of service. But I never got to talk to anybody. I never got to explain. There's not. It's a one-strike rule. And that's true across the board. Your ad just got denied. You don't get to, we're taking your account away. We've frozen your account. That is insane in the world where you're supposed to have a hearing before you lose an asset. And that is an asset that you are actually paying for. So there's a mini soapbox here. But that what we're talking about here is there will be a correction, I think, both legally and in the way that you're about to talk about.
Right. I believe in the meantime, I have a rule of business and life, which is never meet a man on his own battlefield.
It's a good rule.
Yeah. And so you can't win against Facebook. So does that mean don't use it? No, I'm not saying don't use any Facebook marketing or advertising. I'm saying be really smart and selective. In the meantime, the best thing to do is focus on deep, narrow relationships. And part of my personal strategy, business strategy right now is to focus on really high value, high end relationships and businesses that have stratospheric growth opportunities. So I've identified 10 categories of business that are really interesting to me right now that I see as being massive growth. And business is business and marketing is marketing, right? So I don't think any of them are necessarily different, but
could you share a few of them?
Yeah, I definitely can. So one of them that we're talking about is the space venture.
Right.
Space is a $1 trillion opportunity. Right now, the wait to put something in space is 2.5 to 3 years. And China and Russia, they've said, and everyone knows this, they could knock out all of our communication satellites at any time, which would make us blind. The cure for that is to put up a grid of micro and nano satellites that can keep an eye on things. So satellites are like cell phones now. They're smartphones compared to the old days.
Right.
And there's a need to put tens of thousands of them in space. So and the opportunities, the money, et cetera, are just phenomenal. And so that's one of the reasons I got involved in the space venture. Another one that I am really interested right now is entertainment experiences.
Like live physical kind of
yes.
experience?
Okay. Yep. So again, deep, narrow, expensive. But I'll also bridge that with the media side and its podcasts. Right now, the rate of adoption, usage, and also the money that's going into it, Spotify, they earned $1.7 billion. They profited. They netted over $500 million last year. And they've allocated $500 million to acquire Gimlet and Anchor, are two companies they acquired.
Yep.
But they've earmarked even more. And then there's a company called Himalaya.fm that Zimalaya, which is a Chinese company, acquired. The opportunity to bridge our markets between the United States, China, and India are massive. The world is being Americanized business-wise. It's probably going to bounce back to be China-fied soon quite a bit. There's so many things going on with AI right now. But in the meantime, I think for the most part, the world still wants to be America and Americanized. And podcasts are a really effective way to make that happen.
Okay.
And there is an onslaught. There's a glut of podcasts. But what I predict is there are going to be some massive podcast networks that are going to do what Netflix did. And there's going to be a huge investment in content, original content.
So what is the deep and narrow there?
I think the deep and narrow is I use myself as an example and just be transparent.
Yeah.
So I started a podcast with Dan Sullivan from Strategic Coach. Dan is a very well-respected business guy. He's a genius and he's really fascinating. His brain is fascinating. I love the way he thinks. And we just play well together. That's why we decided to do the podcast. We like to do it. And I don't need a lot of clients to have a great business life and a great life in general. And for both of us, there's a lot of people who follow me who should be in Strategic Coach. And there's a lot of Strategic Coach people who are perfect, ideal.
Sure.
Right.
So to blend the audiences and crossover.
Exactly.
Right.
And that can be the tune of like 25 people a year. So I think that's the answer is, and this is the big takeaway. When you ask Dan, what's your marketing strategy? They have free and $20,000. Okay. Now they have some lower end programs, but there's nothing in between.
Right.
That's genius. Mm-hmm. Playing in between is way too busy right now. I think it's just hard. And it's just as hard to sell a product that's $100 as sometimes 10,000.
Yeah.
You know,
we have agreed on that.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what else?
Medicine and longevity. I've been working with a lot of, so specifically.
Kind of Western pharma medicine, regulated stuff or?
No, it's cash-based services. So okay. Functional medicine. Right now, here's the trend that's going on. Doctors are leaving the industry at an alarming rate. There's a need right now for general practitioners. We need three times as many as there are going through school.
Yep.
There's a huge
nurses
glut.
Too, right? Same,
yes,
same challenge.
Massive, yep. Massive. So the smartest entrepreneurial doctors, which many of them are becoming, realize that they have to go to cash-based businesses. And that means they want to build their platforms. They actually want to get seen and noticed. So there's this huge opportunity to serve them, but also that whole industry of longevity, which involves stem cells and cosmetics. And people want to live longer. We've got an aging population. So that's a huge one that I love. And then another one that I'm really interested in right now is food and beverage. And specifically, there's one word that's a $1 trillion opportunity, and it's medical food.
Hmm. Interesting. So what is medical food?
So that would be food that goes beyond supplementation. So it'd be foods that will be purchased by the medical community.
Is there any example now?
Well, I think you're seeing a trend towards CBD and marijuana loaded foods, and consumer packaged good companies are buying them like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think you're gonna see something happen. There's one that I'm involved in right now. It's Good Idea Drinks. I took an advisory role there, and I'm an investor as well. And they have a product that you drink that prevents carb crashes that has been proven in 6 studies. I gotta make sure I'm using the proper terminology here so I don't get anyone in trouble. But the bottom line is it could have some positive effects for diabetes patients. Okay.
Sure.
Nice. So to prevent insulin spikes.
No medical claims
thing.
Here
yeah,
for
exactly.
anyone who's listening. Just,
I'm not exactly
thing.
Sure how to phrase that, know, but let's just say I'm not making any claims at all, but there's some clinical studies
that
supporting.
That might perhaps be something.
Okay. Yeah, there you go.
I like it. Cool. So would you say is your main focus now going forward?
Right now, what's really lighting me up is the podcast for sure. Obviously doing what we're doing. This is a blast. I got a couple books in me. And then deep, narrow advisory roles with companies that are conscious. So my rule is I only work with people I love on businesses I love or can fall in love with. So having deep, meaningful relationships with business owners that want to shift the quality of life and consciousness in an audience really interests me. So that's you know, we're down here looking at the ocean right now. More of this. Like what we did today, you showed up here with your son, recording this podcast. We're in this beautiful environment, having a meaningful conversation that's interesting, intellectually stimulating, and hopefully we're reaching and connecting with some people. And to be able to do that with business as well.
Yeah.
Where do you sign up for that, right?
So for folks that want to get to hold of you and learn more about what you're doing, what are all the places that they should look to do that?
All right. So two places. One of them, definitely check out my podcast with the one and only Dan Sullivan, which is Capability Amplifier. And that's capabilityamplifier.com, or just look for it. And my website, which is just my name, mikekoenigs.com, and it's spelled K-O-E-N-I-G-S.
Good. So many people say that and say things like that and then don't spell it. It's like, but how do I spell that? So that's great. Thank you. So it's K-O-E-N-I-G-S.com. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. And
always fun. You always pull something out of my head I haven't thought about in a long time, Roland, for sure.
Love it.
You've been listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. If you like the show, hit subscribe so we can see you next time. And you can find out more information at businesslunchpodcast.com. Thank you for listening.